welcome to The Sector, the radio show podcast discussing nonprofits, social justice, and activism. With me, your host, Ethan Clow, and we are broadcasting right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Well, happy Friday to all of you listeners who have tuned in live. I'm hoping it's going to be a beautiful day. We've had a lot of them in the last little while. Amazingly hot. Of course, not quite as hot as the rest of Canada, which bakes in the summer. But fortunately here in Vancouver, we get some nice temperate weather, a nice balmy 20 degrees, and we're just happy with that, of course. But if you're listening not live via podcast, or if you've maybe returned to the show after a bit of a break, welcome back. Welcome to the show, whatever time of day it is, whatever day you're listening to it. We here at The Sector, we just never sleep. We're just constantly on. Well, that's not really true, actually. But anyway, getting on with today's show. We have a lot of content to discuss here on The Sector today. Some interesting news items happening in the realm of nonprofits and social justice. For instance, the recent PETA-related snafu. Of course, I'm referring to the milk autism connection that PETA recently promoted. We'll discuss that a little bit later. As well as some new anti-spam legislation that's going to affect how nonprofits communicate with their members, supporters, and donors. So we'll talk a bit about that. And of course, we will get into the big question. We'll discuss last week's one. And of course, we will have a new big question on today's show. So stay tuned for that. Later on, I want to get into a discussion, something that I've been meaning to talk about for a while now here on The Sector. And that is culture. And no, not culture as in what is the culture of Canada or what is the culture of France or England or Germany. I'm talking about organizational culture, which is the culture of an organization. It could be a nonprofit. It could be a private corporation. It could be a foundation, any kind of group of people, whether it's for charitable purposes or not, is going to have a culture that exists within its walls. So I want to talk a bit about that and what that actually means for the nonprofit world, but what it also means for an activist. And when you step inside a nonprofit as a volunteer, maybe even as a staff person, or perhaps as a consultant, or maybe you're just a new involved person and you want to get to know a place. Well, you want to zero in on what is the organizational culture. And we'll dive in more detail. What does this actually mean? And perhaps, as we further discuss it, is organizational culture something that, like the donor pyramid on last week's show, a bit antiquated, perhaps a bit archaic, a old way of thinking about organizations, nonprofits, and activism? Well, we'll see. We'll dive into it and discuss it. So today will be a very busy show. Let's start things off, though, with the nonprofit news and the recent milk-related snafu of PETA. Now, here on The Sector, we have a rule about criticizing other nonprofits, criticizing other causes. This is something that I experimented with on Radio Free Thinker, and it was based on the mentality that all of us, we're all trying to be change agents. We're all trying to make the world a better place. We're all trying to work together. And we're embracing the views of humanism, of tolerance, of goodwill to help make that change happen. So I don't like to pick on other nonprofits because it just seems like it's shooting ourselves in the foot. Having been involved in the process and, you know, being on the other side of the fence where someone's picking on us for a campaign or a mistake, it can really feel demoralizing because you don't see the hard work that goes into it behind the scenes. And when someone comes along and makes fun of you or criticizes you, you really feel like you're backed into a corner. Now, that being said, I do have a slight caveat to that whole Creed, that whole soapbox that I was just standing on. And that is the science, because unlike, well, to a certain degree, unlike other fields, other areas of scholarly and critical inquiry, science is a very cut and dry worldview. And I don't mean to be pessimistic about that. I mean it in quite the sense that there either is an answer or there isn't. It's one or the other. It's binary. In most social justice arenas, that's not the case. We almost hardly ever have binary decisions. There's always nuances and shades of gray that we have to tease out and debate and question and analyze. But with science, well, I mean, to use a simplistic analogy, if you get hit with a cannon, you're either dead or you're not. You're not half dead. One or the other exists. So I always get nervous when nonprofits enter that realm of science, because if they're not trained at it, well, you make mistakes. And as they say, there is no use crying over spilt milk. Because the story is about milk. So PETA, that of course is People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, has recently put out a, what we could call maybe an advertisement or a opinion piece about milk, essentially linking the risk of autism to dairy products. Now, a good rule of thumb for science, critical thinking, and elsewhere, anytime you hear someone try to link autism to something, usually that's a red flag. Autism, of course, is a broad spectrum of behavioral issues related to the brain. We're not even really sure exactly how autism works, what causes it, what are its mitigating factors, and how that spectrum works. All we really know is that it's extremely complicated, and we don't have clear-cut binary answers. Now I'm coming back to the whole question of binary. Science doesn't have an answer for this one yet. We're still figuring this out. What we are pretty sure of, though, is that making claims that something or other causes autism or is linked to autism is usually wrong. Because we know with a certain degree of certainty that drinking milk is not going to have a tangible impact on the development of autism. Much like the vaccine debate that raged on and continues to rage on, after years of research and looking at data, we can tell that there is not a tangible link between vaccines and autism. And yet this myth persists. And part of the reason why it persists is because autism is a fairly mysterious condition. We're not quite sure about it. That doesn't mean that we should be, you know, loose with the facts and just say, well, yeah, maybe milk does cause autism. Who knows? Well, no, we actually do know a few things about autism. We know enough about it to make some reasonable conclusions. One being that going out there and saying that X, Y, and Z causes autism is dangerous, it's wrong, and it's an embarrassment to the organization. Now, when it comes to claims like this of a medical nature, I turn to Science-Based Medicine, a blog put on by medical experts who rigorously investigate claims like this. They look at the research, they look at the scientific consensus, and they package it in an easy-to-understand blog post that is quite excellent. And just reading the one that was posted on Science-Based Medicine by Dr. Stephen Novella, you can see that the scientific consensus is that there is no link between dairy products and autism. In 2010, they did a study, a controlled blinded scientific study, where they had children with gluten-free and casein-free diets. They had autism, and they thought, okay, well, if there's something to this, then if we give these children dairy products, we'll see a worsening of symptoms. So what they did is they divided the children into three categories. They had one who continued sort of the gluten-free, dairy-free diet. They had one that had a placebo diet and one that had a dairy diet. there was no significant change in behavior in any of the children. This sort of study is the foundation of scientific research. It weeds out confirmation bias. It reads out that tendency that we have as human beings to see patterns where they don't exist, or to attribute the effect of something to a practice that we're doing. You know, oftentimes, if we think that a dairy-free diet is going to help a child, and we put them on said diet, we are just going to pick up on every little thing that they do and think, oh, look, it's working. When in fact, it wasn't having an impact at all. It was just us sort of looking for any possible clue. And even when we don't really see it, we just kind of imagine that we do. And that's how these sort of cognitive biases work. It sounds complicated and counterintuitive. And well, that's because it is. It is counterintuitive. It is complicated. And that's why I get nervous when nonprofits start talking about science, because science is complicated and counterintuitive. It relies on double-blinded scientific studies, which are not easy to explain, as I'm demonstrating. And a nonprofit, when they step into the science world, typically are going to make mistakes like this. And of course, that raises the other question. Does PETA even really understand what they've just put out there? Because maybe they do. And this is where things get icky, is because this sort of thing has the tendency to go viral. Thanks to people like Jenny McCarthy and Oprah and Dr. Oz, who have made sort of the anti-establishment medical degree field booming, a lot of parents think that, you know, they can rely on their instincts as parents, their gut feeling, and this sort of folksy wisdom appeals to that sense of, I don't need a degree to understand how science works. And unfortunately, this has led to some pretty big tragedies in the past little while. I mean, I've mentioned before the vaccine issue. We are facing breakouts of measles, record high cases because of anti-vaccination efforts. And again, this sort of ties into that whole thing of, if PETA is trying to get publicity, if they're just trying to spread around some fear because they have an ideological, you know, reason to not want you to drink milk, that just makes things even more icky and I think damages a reputation as a nonprofit. I will have the blog post from Science-Based Medicine. I will post it on our show notes so you can go and take a look at it. I do recommend it. It's a great read. Dr. Stephen Novella is a friend, and he is a fantastic writer who's really good at sort of taking complex issues and explaining it in a way that is really clear and easy to understand. So I do encourage you to check it out and join me in sort of wagging our finger at PETA. Bad PETA. Well, let's take a quick break here on The Sector. We will return after these important messages about CITR and UBC Radio.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the Main Street area at
Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, RX Comics, Red Cat Records, the Regional Assembly of Text, the Rumpus Room, the Wallflower Modern Diner, and Woo Vintage Clothing.
Wow, it sure does pay to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus, or go online to www.citr.ca.
Keep smiling. Keep shining, knowing you can always count on me. For sure, that's what friends are for.
I imagined what it would be like to be a wizard, and then I pretended and acted in that way on the day.
Studies show that 9 out of 10 wizards prefer CITR 101.9 FM.
If we were to draw a graph of my process, of my method, something like this, Sir Ian, action, wizard, you shall not pass, cut! Sir Ian.
And we are back here on The Sector on CITR. So we're talking about the new anti-spam legislation here in Canada. And you might be thinking, well, I'm sure you're thinking of some kind of Monty Python era joke, and I'm not going to go there because we have class here on The Sector. So I'm going to go right to the facts. What exactly is the CASL? And you might be asking yourself, what is that? And that, of course, is the Canadian anti-spam law. I don't know who gets paid to name these things because that wasn't creative enough. Anyway, the CASL is designed to impact both private organizations as well as nonprofit charities. So this is going to affect every business in Canada, essentially. From the sort of small mom-and-pop stores to the big retailers, and of course to the nonprofits out there that rely on newsletters, communications, or social media contact with the public, their supporters, their donors. So this is going to have far-reaching consequences. One might wonder exactly how pressing the need was for such legislation, and I guess I'm also joining that question. I mean, was there a big problem with nonprofits harassing people in the mail? I don't actually know that. I'm not trying to be, you know, funny or poking fun at this. I'm actually curious. Do people think that we need this in Canada? Is there a big concern that spam is taking over? I know that when I get spam in my email, for instance, I usually just delete it. In some cases, I block it or I set up my spam filters. It really hasn't been a huge problem for me. But again, not all laws are set up for my personal benefit, so this could be one of those situations. The CASL is designed to protect Canadians from the, quote, harmful effects of spam and related threats to electronic commerce, and is working towards a safer and more secure online marketplace, end quote. There are three overarching rules related to the anti-spam laws. One, a organization must obtain, quote, expressed or implied consent to send a message. Two, an organization must, quote, clearly and simply identify yourselves and anyone else on whose behalf the message is being sent. And three, every message you send must, quote, provide a way for recipients to unsubscribe from receiving messages in the future. So that sounds relatively simple. The new rules come into effect on July 1st, and it becomes enforceable immediately. Under the new rules, there are penalties for breaking these laws, up to $1 million for an inadvertent or unintentional breaking of the rules, all the way up to $10 million for the intentional breaking of these rules. And again, I can understand that spam would be really annoying if you kept getting it, but $1 million annoying? I don't know. But they didn't ask me, so let's investigate further. So what sort of impact is this going to have for charity? Well, in examining this further, we've discovered some interesting caveats. Depending on how the charity is using their mailing list, they may have an exemption. Under the CASL, for specific fundraising activities, if the messages being sent out are strictly seeking donations, and they can be documented in such a way, then there won't be much of an issue. Which is interesting, because that would seem to be the most irritating aspect of spammy messages from a nonprofit, is when they're seeking a donation. Yet interestingly enough, this provides an exemption for charities. Of course, this all breaks down into how the charities will be affected by this, and that is yet to be seen, as essentially this sort of new legislation has never been tested before. And as I mentioned before, charities haven't exactly been known to spam people to this extent. So it's going to be interesting to see how they adapt. Now, what's interesting, of course, is that as long as the charity isn't offering a commercial aspect of this, then the CASL doesn't really apply. If they're doing direct fundraising, that's exempt. As long as the charity gets explicit consent from the supporter, from the person receiving the messages, they are essentially golden. They are fine, because that's part of the rules. So expect from now on that whenever you're signing up for a charity's newsletter or you're reading a story and they offer to give you more information, there's probably going to be a little checkbox that says, I agree to be put on the mailing list and receive further communication. And chances are it's going to be automatically checked and that you will have to uncheck it in order to opt out. That's a common trick in sort of cognitive science, is that if there's a little bit of extra work implied to check out, less people will actually do it. So it'll be interesting to see how this actually does impact the charitable sector, if it does at all. I think that any nonprofit, of course, that hasn't got a consent for people to receive its messages, and that they're just sort of willy-nilly sending them out, well, chances are that wasn't a very good nonprofit in the first place. Consent is very important because this is an organization, a sector based on trust. And if you break that trust by sending out tons of spammy emails, well, I don't think you're going to do very well in the long term. Let's take another quick break here on the sector. We will return after this.
Jazz is a word that means many different things to many different people. The best definition of jazz that I know of is the jazz show on CITR with yours truly, Gavin Walker. Monday nights, 9 to midnight, with the jazz feature at 11 o'clock. Check us out every Monday.
Time ago, in a city far, far away,
CITR
was born. In the decade ahead, America will be in space.
CITR
is already there. Astronaut Neil Armstrong had this to say about
CITR.
It's one small step for man.
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Herbert R. Tarlick, Chairman.
And we're back on the sector here on CITR with me, Ethan Clow, your host. And it's now time for the big question of the week. This is, of course, where we review the question that we asked last week on the show. And remember, if you want to participate in the big question of the week, there is many ways to do so. You can visit us online at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com, or you can contribute on Facebook at facebook.com/sectorpodcast, or you can tweet us on Twitter at sectorpodcast, or you can tweet me at Ethan Clow. I'm on Twitter as well. And of course, you can email us at sectorpodcast@gmail.com. Now, all this being said, what was last week's big question? And I was talking a bit about debate and argument, and I posed the question, when was the last time that you sat down, you know, normally face to face, for a reasonable discussion, conversation, or debate with somebody who didn't share your point of view? So immediately we can disqualify all those sort of Facebook arguments that we get into because, well, frankly, they don't really count in this case. That's not a face-to-face discussion. And we can also discount all those times where we find ourselves in a bit of an echo chamber. And I mentioned last week how we tend to gravitate towards people who already agree with us, people who they see our point of view, they respect our point of view, they even embrace our point of view, because that's why we're friends with them. Who wants to hang around people who hate us all the time? But when was the last time that wasn't the case, where you actually had to make a case for what you believed in. And you were talking to someone who didn't buy what you thought was true. What was that like for you? So we got some interesting responses, a couple of emails, and I don't think we have time to read all of them, but they were very enlightening for me because I think that, well, I think that a lot of people had a very similar reaction. One, that they just don't have those conversations as much anymore. It seems like that for us, when we come across an argument or a point where we disagree, we tend to immediately withdraw from the conversation. We go, oh, this is tricky territory. Let's talk about something else. And we quickly change the subject. We never really engage on the controversial point. At least that's what I read in your emails. Another interesting point was that really the sort of social media side has kind of taken over that role. Nowadays, it seems that all of our intense conversations are happening on Facebook or Twitter or, you know, in an email exchange, which probably is not a very good thing because we're not very good at communicating over social media in a way that allows for vigorous debate, because so much of how we communicate is through body language, it's through tone, it's through how we express and use our words. And with Facebook and Twitter and all those other options is that you can't detect those things. You can't detect someone's body language. You can't detect their tone. You don't know if they're, you know, joking around as they say something or if they're looking quizzled and expressive. It's hard to tell these sort of things. And that's where arguments can be resolved and where they can be de-escalated. And if we don't have that sort of secondary feedback, arguments tend to escalate into realms that we weren't really anticipating. Now, I want to maybe share sort of my own point of view on this and with my own sort of unique story. A little while ago, I was having a rather interesting conversation with a friend of mine, actually quite a close friend. We weren't, you know, enemies or, you know, born on opposite sides of town or something. We were contemporaries for the most part, and we were discussing harm reduction drug policy. And I think we've talked about, you know, Insight as on the past here on the sector, and we've definitely mentioned it on Radio Free Thinker for listeners of both shows. But this was a sort of a new topic to bring up with my friend here. And as we were debating this, we kind of got onto the subject of statistics, of measuring things through science and critical thinking, numbers, facts, figures, that sort of thing. Now, much to my surprise, my friend did not share my point of view that this is a reliable way of learning about the world and basing it on something that we can make an opinion on. He took a far more, perhaps, emotional take in that sometimes things just feel wrong. They don't feel correct. There's a gut-churning instinct that you have that tells you when something is right or wrong. And I wasn't necessarily disagreeing with that point, but I was saying that, well, actually, stats and figures and maths and science can cut through our discomfort and help us arrive at a conclusion that's more reliable. Now, this debate really erupted at this point. We were arguing quite heatedly at each other. And it was really surprising for me how difficult it was to engage in rational discussion with somebody who sort of rejected tenets of rational discussion. Because if we can't agree on a neutral benchmark, if we can't agree on a measuring system for quantifying what it is we're talking about, stats, science, whatever, how can we reach any kind of conclusion? How can we discuss this without basically relying on who's louder or who has the cleverer rhetoric to make a decision? So from that point forward, I always tried to change my debate tactics a little bit. Instead of focusing on things that I personally find convincing, like stats and figures and math and sciences, I said, okay, well, maybe I need to rearrange my tactics and start talking about it from the point of view of what convinces other people. Now, in that particular case, I'm not really sure how I would have gone down that, because in that particular case, we ended at sort of, you know, bashing our heads together, and that was sort of the end of the conversation. But looking back on it, and perhaps maybe we can apply this to other debates that we have, how can we change that course? And I would suggest that maybe we need to approach this discussion in a way that we think would convince someone else. In other words, we might think that logic and stats are convincing for us, but they aren't for someone else. So we have to figure out a way to get across what we're intending, but to code it in a way that they find palatable. This is an interesting question that I think a lot of science communicators have, is how to get across the point without relying on something that people naturally kind of resist, which is stats. And an interesting way of doing this is with emotion. And I know that a lot of, you know, logical arguments, debate club people are right now recoiling in horror that I would suggest that. But I think it's actually a valid point that relying sometimes on emotion and perhaps, you know, manipulating or pushing emotional buttons can sometimes open up more doors than we care to admit. For the nonprofit sector, this is not all that extraordinary news. I think a lot of us know that nonprofits are actually pretty good at pushing those emotional buttons. When you get a direct mail appeal from a nonprofit, they're not going to give you a lot of stats and figures and databases, charts and pie charts, and basically a, you know, big Excel sheet. They're going to give you a really emotional picture of a starving child and with some crayon drawings that the child drew, please help me get food, because that's going to make an impact more than charts and figures, at least for those of us who, you know, have emotions. So I think that for us as activists, as proponents of social justice, we have to not just learn the figures and facts and understand the ins and outs of what it is we're talking about. We also have to learn how to present it in a way that other people are not going to have knee-jerk reactions to. And, you know, sometimes it's not going to be emotion. That's not going to be the key to getting our point across. It might be something else entirely. It might be about bringing the debate into their world, making it something that they can understand based on their personal experience. And that can be, of course, incredibly difficult, because certain causes by nature are isolated from the average person here in Canada. Poverty issues, for instance. But at least it's a start. And I appreciate everybody who shared their stories with me for the big question. Let's go on to our new big question of the week. And of course, we will invite your feedback on this, whether it's on Facebook or Twitter or via email. Please do contribute. Let me know what you think. This week's big question is a bit of a tricky one. Do you feel that Canada is a generous nation? Now, keeping in mind what we just discussed about facts and figures not always being, you know, the most convincing thing, I want an emotional answer. I want something based on gut instinct. I want an answer that you don't look at charts and figures and stats on giving in Canada. Tell me what you feel in your emotional core. Do you feel that Canada and Canadians are generous? It could be giving to charity. It could be international aid. It could just be in general. Are we a kind, generous, giving people? I'm really curious to hear what you have to say about this, so let us know. Again, you can tweet us at The Sector Podcast or at me, Ethan Clow. You can email us at sectorpodcast@gmail.com or comment on our blogs or on Facebook. Well, while you think that over, let's get on with today's show and our discussion of culture. Now, as I mentioned before, we're not talking about culture in the same sense that we talk about it with regards to Canada or America or even locally, like what is the culture in Vancouver. We're talking about organizational culture, and that means what is the culture that is created and that people work with when they're in an organization. It could be a corporation. It could be a nonprofit. It could even be something as simple as, you know, your home business, or it could be as big and as encompassing as a major conglomerate corporation like an Apple or a Microsoft. So what do we mean when we say organizational culture? In fact, there are many different ways to describe it and to think about it. We could think about it in terms of how people dress and behave in the workplace. We can talk about the level of formality. Is everybody sort of Mr. Smith and Mr. James, or is things more casual? Do we talk about people on a first name basis? Does the boss or supervisor, you know, walk in and know everybody's name and shakes hand, is friendly, cracking jokes? Or is it a uptight environment where you're expected to arrive on time and you don't leave until that last second ticks away at the end of the day? All of these things are important, not just for a potential new employee, but if you're a potential donor or volunteer, well, you're going to want to understand what culture is before you get involved with an organization. Now, in thinking about culture, one of the ways that we can visualize it is with an iceberg. I rather like this analogy because I think it's very useful for understanding how a culture actually works, as opposed to sort of how we might understand it in a casual or, you know, not really scientific sense. So, you know, with an iceberg, you have the top of it, which sits above the water, it's visible. It might be small or big, depending on the kind of organization that we're talking about. And then, of course, you have the chunk of it that's underneath. And, you know, with an iceberg, typically, this can be huge. You could have a tiny little portion that sticks above water, and this big menacing mountain of an iceberg underwater that is a hazard for passing ships. So if we look at the top of it, well, what does that equate to? And typically that would be something like the physical structure of the organization. How is it laid out? What is the paint scheme? You know, these may seem like minor details, but they can play a big role. If you work in a big gray office space with big gray cubicles and, you know, tan carpet and everybody wears a gray suit, well, that's going to impact culture. If you work in a sort of dynamic open space environment where their desks are at weird angles and the paints are reds and greens and blues and polka dots, that's going to have an impact on culture. Another thing that has an impact is language, and that obviously doesn't just mean what language you're speaking in the office, although that can be a big factor as well. If your office is bilingual or trilingual, or you have conversations that are happening in Japanese and Chinese and English and Korean and French and German, well, that's going to have a very sort of worldly impact on your organization. But it also refers to things like how you express yourselves. Is it a very casual environment, sort of like how I'm doing the sector right now? I'm not using intense formal language, not even really using correct language at times. But that being said, if you have an environment where everything is Mr. So-and-so or Miss So-and-so or yes, boss, yes, sir, yes, ma'am, that's going to have an impact on culture. If you have a very casual environment where everybody is on a first name basis with everybody else, that's going to have a very different culture than what I've mentioned previously. Then you have rituals and ceremonies. And I don't mean, again, in the sense that they're getting together with candles and performing a ritual, but there are certain things that offices do, that businesses do, that become a ritual of expression. So for instance, Does your office send around a morning email that everybody bounces around and says, good morning, have a great day, and the sun is shining, blah, blah, blah. You know, maybe you have one of those announcement PA speakers, and every morning the team lead comes on and gives a rousing cheer to speed you on your day. It's very common in certain fields to have these kind of morning rituals to get yourself energized and engaged on the daily task. And then, of course, you have stories and legends. And this is an interesting aspect as well, because this celebrates the history, the origins of your organization. In many companies, this is very important because depending on who owns them, who's running the organizations, that can mean very different things. Is it a family-run business? Perhaps a family-run business that's been in operation for more than 100 years. Maybe it's a family-run business that's been passed down, and maybe it's independently owned, or maybe the employees all own the majority of shares. So this is all going to impact the social milieu of the organization, depending on how that is passed on to the employees. You know, maybe there are important cornerstone events that happened in the organization's history, and these are passed along to people in the form of legends. And, you know, the new person arrives in the office, and sooner or later they hear the story about how their supervisor stood up in a board meeting one day and said to the boss, no, you're plain wrong, and we should do things this way. And, you know, magically things changed. They started doing things that way. And that's how, you know, the organization came to be. These sorts of aspects are really important for establishing what kind of an environment it's going to be that you're going to work in. And again, if you're a volunteer or if you're a donor, these sorts of things are really important, because depending on the outward appearance of culture, that could be a big impact on whether or not you choose to donate. If you're a very wealthy person and you grew up in sort of a formal environment, you're probably not likely to donate to one of these sort of brand new Gen Y flavored charities, you know, where everyone arrives at work and, you know, shorts and a t-shirt, and it's very casual, it's very focused on the individual. Not that there's anything wrong with that. It's just that's not your style. You're going to go to a more formal organization, one that has a longer history, where the staff are more formal with each other and with you. And you're going to find that more appealing to you from a cultural point of view. Now, that is the top of the iceberg. What about the bottom of the iceberg, the part that's underwater? What about that? Well, let's dive into that, no pun intended. But first, why don't we take just a quick little break here on the sector, a chance for us to think about what we've just been talking about and let it all, you know, sink in. Okay, whatever, I'll stop with the puns. We'll be right back after this quick break here on the show.
The federal government is trying to ram through a set of electronic surveillance laws that will invade your privacy and cost you money. The plan is to force every phone and internet provider to surrender our personal information to authorities without a warrant. The worst part of their invasive, all-encompassing surveillance scheme is that you have to pay for it out of your own pocket. Send Ottawa a message by signing the petition at stopspying.ca. That's www.stopspying.ca. Thank you.
My name is David Scott. I play wide receiver for the University of British Columbia football team, and I'm here to discuss the Be More Than a Bystander program. Myself and a few other players were lucky enough to work alongside the BC Lions and EVA, the Ending Violence Association, to support this cause. The main goal of the Be More Than a Bystander initiative is to increase awareness of domestic violence against women. For more information on the cause, please visit endingviolence.org.
And we are back here on The Sector, the radio show podcast discussing nonprofits, social justice, and activism with me, your host, Ethan Clow. And we're just talking about organizational culture And I gave the iceberg analogy, and I know that some people don't care for this analogy. They think it's a bit antiquated, a bit old school, but I rather like it. And we just discussed sort of the top of the iceberg, the part that's visible above the sea, the physical structure, the language, the rituals and ceremonies, and the stories and legends of an organization. All of these things impact how a new volunteer, a new employee, a potential donor, all of these things are visible. They can see them. They can sense them. They can interact with them. But what about below the iceberg? What about beneath the sea, the invisible side of culture, which is just as important and, well, in many ways, even more important? So underneath the iceberg, you have the shared values and the shared assumptions that govern the organization, that inform it, that tell it what is right and what is wrong. Now, these are tricky at times because, well, shared values are relatively conscious. We're aware of them. They help us evaluate what is right and what is wrong. I mean, and you can sort of see this, of course, in the private sector when there is, well, how should we put it? When there is fraud, when there is illegal activities going on, these organizations, they have a culture that says, well, it's not morally wrong for us to maybe break the law or do something that's a bit illegal if it makes us profit, if it maximizes the return on investment for our shareholders. In some cases, you have nonprofits who I like to think have a bit more humanitarian focus for value. And, you know, getting back to sort of the spam thing with the new regulations, they would say, well, listen, it's in our best interest to not spam our supporters. Even though, as long as we're fundraising, it's okay to do so, is that the right thing to do, to be constantly badgering them for more money? Well, most nonprofits would probably say it's not right to do that. That's their shared values. That's that core component of the culture that you can't really tell by just walking around an office space. You wouldn't notice that unless they have it, you know, demonstrated in front of you. Now, I mentioned the shared assumptions. These are different. These are different from values. Assumptions are non-conscious. They're not necessarily at the forefront of our mind. We kind of do these things without even really realizing that we're doing them. We kind of take them for granted. These are the beliefs that help inform us how to do things that we don't give a lot of conscious time to investigate. Now, it's difficult to give exact examples of this sort of thing without getting into kind of jargony in-speak for organizational culture. But we can think about this in terms of things like espoused and enacted values. And you might ask, well, what does that even mean? Well, one could say that we espouse to have a certain set of values, whether we're in the nonprofit sector or not. We espouse to be about helping people, about making a difference, about being guided by mission and focused on how to do more mission. And then, of course, we have our enacted values. This is what actually happens. So we may say that we're dedicated to X cause, but our actions are demonstrated enacted behaviors don't show that. They show a different set of values. Maybe we're more focused on fundraising. Maybe we're more focused on these other sets of causes that aren't actually related to mission. And in which case, perhaps we're not a very good nonprofit if that's the case. In the for-profit sector, you know, you could look at an organization that espouses to care about the environment, to be concerned about preserving natural beauty and the ecosystem and the welfare of everybody who lives off of that ecosystem. Then you compare it to their enacted values, what they actually do, what their motives and behaviors actually show. So for instance, despite saying that they care deeply about the environment, the proponents of, say, the big pipeline here in BC, well, their enacted values are that they drill into the ground and suck oil up. And they don't seem to care too much about the ecosystem at that point. So that's a bit of a way to look at sort of the under the iceberg way of culture. Because again, you wouldn't notice this by just sort of walking into an office space. You would only realize this after the fact, after being part of the organization for a while. And if you're in a nonprofit, as a volunteer or a staff person, by this point, you may change your view. You may come to see this as something that's okay, because you're now indoctrinated into the culture. You're part of it. So you may rationalize when you do things that are against your espoused values. If you're a donor, well, this is all the more important, because you want to make sure that the money that you're donating, or even the resources that you're donating, are actually going to the cause that you think is important. Sometimes, you know, an unscrupulous charity might say that we're all about solving problem X, when in reality, maybe they're more focused on problem Y. But they just think that, you know, Mr. Big Shot is only concerned with problem X and won't give if they're off busy doing problem Y. So they just sort of say, well, we kind of do both. Well, that's not really true, is it? So for a donor, it's really important. For a volunteer, it's really important, because as a volunteer, you're donating time. You're donating your energy. And if that is going to waste, or if you feel like you're being misled, well, that can really put you off of volunteering and taking part. And, you know, that's not really helpful for anybody, is it? Now, we're running out of time here on the sector, and once again, I do appreciate everyone sticking out to the end here on episode 10 of the sector. But there is sort of one other question to do with organizational culture that is important, and that is the question of just how much should we consider the legacies and lessons of organizational culture? There is an argument out there that this way of looking at culture is a bit archaic. It's a bit old-fashioned. And what does that mean for, in our term of the discussion, for nonprofits? Well, an interesting aspect is the increased globalization. And I mentioned how you can have an organization where people are speaking Japanese and English and French and German, and you have this kind of multicultural, multidimensional organization that's thriving. In much the same way, modern nonprofits that are sort of breaking the mold, as I mentioned before, with a younger, a more open-ended, a more dynamic environment where there is less structure, less rules, but still at its core, mission and the desire to do good, this is somewhat bucking the trend a little bit here with culture, because it goes back to this notion that if we look at culture as a stabilizing agent, a way to sort of give social glue to an organization to help them understand what's right and what's wrong, to moderate and provide strength to an organization, well, maybe some organizations don't necessarily have that same setup. I mean, the opposite of not having sort of that form of culture would be, you know, either like a cult-like or a weak or a unstable environment. But what we've actually seen is that in some cases, having a more fluid, a more multifaceted culture that is less defined, perhaps I can use that term, is less nailed down, does not always equate into sort of chaos as we would kind of expect. Instead, this could create sort of an interesting dynamic between how an organization like a nonprofit actually functions. In previous episodes, we talked about social enterprise. There's other aspects to this that are starting to come up to the forefront in the nonprofit sector. Smaller organizations that focus on smaller, more manageable tasks. Organizations that function largely online, using different tools than their forebears. Online fundraising, things like Kickstarter and Indiegogo. Social media, using primarily smartphones and tablets as the primary means of transmitting information. Interestingly enough, the website, as we've known it for nonprofits, is morphing. It seems that more and more people are getting their information via social media. That's becoming more important than a stable website, than sort of a fluid, dynamic, interactive form of experience. So what we can take away from this, I think, is that culture for an organization is extremely important. But how we define that culture and how that culture interacts with the rest of the organization, its donors, its supporters, the public, that is open for debate. Well, we are running out of time here on the sector. So once again, I will remind everybody, please follow us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. We are at Facebook/Sector Podcast. We are on Twitter @Sector Podcast, or you can follow me @Ethan Clow. And visit us online at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. You can download our show notes as well as the podcast itself. So if you don't want to get up Friday mornings, just download the podcast. Listen whenever you feel like it. Don't worry, we don't care. As long as you listen, we're happy. Well, this is Ethan Clow, your host, saying once again, thank you for listening, and we will see you next week. Goodbye.
Australia and Canada are both countries with a whole lot of space to create some of the wildest sounds on the planet. Join your host Matthew as he explores the musical heritage of his native Australia and features fresh sounds from Canada's independent music world. That's Stranded, the Australian-Canadian music show, live Fridays from 6 to 7:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM. And I'm stranded on my own. Stranded far from home. All right.
Sunny days, gonna keep me outside right on the shade. Gonna keep me outside right on the shade. It's gonna be like this, and that's right, that's okay. Is that okay? Myself with big tears lying to my head. I'm dead tired of the shit you call this fucking bitch. You don't know when to stop. You're launching fat bitches, motherfucking fat bitches. Ah, why don't wanna be trapped in the black of your heart? How could a fuck think so fucked?